And once again, we wedge our way in between Car Talk and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me for an hour of conversation and also a little look at the condition of music in Composer's Datebook. Our guest today is from Purdue University, which means I have to speak, I suppose, in proper English. But we'll get through it. Another session of Saturday Morning Live, portions of which are in fact recorded. And support for Saturday Morning Live comes from the Quad Cities Community Foundation, working to ensure that generosity always lives here by offering professional assistance and tools for charitable giving. Learn more at area 563-326-62640 or qccommunityfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Good Samaritan Society Heritage Court in Davenport, a senior living community that offers those aged 55 and older meals, housekeeping, and scheduled transportation. Information on amenities and tours is available at area 563-210-3401. Before I do anything else, let me be sure I give you the correct telephone number for Quad Cities Community Foundation, area 563-326-2840. That's the way it goes, Liz. Liz Mercier, I am delighted that you took time to visit with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Without you, it would just be me talking for an hour, and that is a very depressing thing. You are at Purdue University. What do you do there?
I teach all levels of Latin and ancient Greek, and I also teach some etymology courses, like medical and scientific terminology from Greek and Latin roots, that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, medical terminology, you know, there's every discipline has its own language.
Yes, it does.
And you have to speak the language if you want to be taken seriously.
That's very true.
But all levels of Latin, oh my, this brings back painful memories. I took so much Latin to no avail. Cogito ergo sum is about as far as I can go now. Do people still sign up to take Latin?
Yes, they do. I mean, I think historically there's been rises and falls in terms of its popularity. And also regionally, I think that you know, some areas of the country, it might be more or less popular than other areas of the country. I think Iowa in particular, I read an article a few years back that there was no one in Iowa that taught Latin anymore. And I was just told by Roald that there's a Latin teacher now at Central High School. So I think the ancient languages fall in and out of vogue. But at Purdue, Purdue's mainly a STEM school. It's a big engineering school. But there are a healthy number of students that take Latin and obviously a slightly smaller number of students that study ancient Greek.
You know, I was just reading an article in the Times Literary Supplement about a guy who went to a meeting of the MLA, I think that's the Modern Language Association, and he talked about the terrible fall off in numbers since the last time he was there. This is English.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about kids taking English and going into a master's program, and out of eight that would be in a class, one would wind up teaching English, the rest would go into other professions. And he thought that English majors going into other professions is a good idea because any humanistic element you can bring into the sciences is really worth it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think when you study the ancient languages, it doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go off and teach Latin or teach ancient Greek, as I decided to do, but it's more the mental acrobatics that it puts your mind through. You have to hone your skills in analysis, because the ancient languages are so much more heavily inflected. And so the just to wrap your mind around the grammatical system, it's much more heavily developed system. Nouns, for instance, change their forms depending upon how they're functioning in a sentence. So in an English sentence, the word dog is dog, whether it's the subject or the direct object or the indirect object. But in Latin, the word dog changes its form. If it's the subject, it looks different, has a different ending than if it's the direct object.
Canis.
Exactly.
I remember.
That's wonderful. Good for you, from which we get the word canine. Excellent.
Well, that's the thing about Latin that I discovered. When you look at a long word, you check the parts and you think, I kind of get where this is going, because I remember the prefixes and suffixes and so on. And they come from Latin, which influenced Italian and French and all the rest. And English just garbages up everything. It takes in everything you can think of, from the European languages to Hindu, to you name it. English is a language that is just a vast collection of stuff.
That's very true. But many of those English words are related to Latin and Greek roots. And there are two benefits, I guess, of studying the languages, the ancient languages. And one of them is that grammatical element that I was talking about, where if you've studied some basic Latin, you can talk about what a participle is or talk about what a gerund is. So it really hones your sense of English grammar and English syntax. But the other thing is that the thing that you were talking about, where you see a difficult word and you look for Latin roots that you know in it. And those are some of the most valuable courses I think I teach, are those etymology courses, because across disciplines, no matter what you're studying, you can't think of a vocabulary word in the same way if you've studied those root elements and you understand how dynamic they are. And so one of the things when I teach the medical and scientific terminology course at Purdue, I always stress how this is the Latin root, and if it comes through French, the spelling changes in this way. And so if you see it, this root spelled in this way, that means that it comes from, it's Latin via French. And I tell my students that if they can't come out of my course being completely distracted by words, then I didn't do a good job teaching them.
I'm distracted by words. I really am. And I'm fascinated with language itself. I remember walking down a street in London years ago when we used to do tours over there. I was just fascinated because people would pass by and I'd hear these sounds and I'd think, I don't know what that is. And the sounds would vary so dramatically. When you would hear someone speaking Vietnamese, you think, what is that? The noise, not noises, but the sounds were ing, and just the change, I guess just the change in inflection, whether you took this sound up a few notes, changed the meaning of the word. And I think, how does anyone ever straighten that out? But then you look at English and you think, well, how does anyone ever straighten this out? I would hate to be coming into this country, as many people do, and have to learn English, because it's so confusing. And Latin made sense in a certain way, but I just could not wrap my head around the different way sentences were put together. How did you first develop an interest in this?
Well, I wanted to take Latin in high school, and I graduated in 1983 from Central High School. And the year I came in as a freshman, there were three students signed up for Latin: my brother, me, and another kid. And so they decided that year that it was going to be dropped. And we tried to make a fuss to no avail, and I took German in high school. But I was eager to study it in high school, and so I wasn't able to start it until my first year of college. And from the first time I took it, I was fascinated by it, but it was also one of the things that I found most difficult. It took me a long time to master the grammatical structures, and it's as I was talking about how heavily inflected it is, it's a very difficult to grasp grammatical system. And it was one of the things I struggled with the most, and I sort of kicked in my heels and said, I'm going to master this. It was a tremendous challenge to me. And that was very attractive. And then once I was able to get some level of success and begin reading in the language, then my love for it grew further. And then I started taking ancient Greek my junior year and fell in love with that even more. And so it just kind of built from there.
Boy, I envy you. I do. I used to direct Greek plays all the time. And what I would do is I'd get every available translation I could find and sit the books in front of me and then start typing, stealing a line here, trying to follow the thought, condensing something, expanding something, and just coming out with what I hoped was a close version of what the play was about. But the translations are all over the lot. Some translators go in for poetry, and some want to be, they want to transliterate, and you don't really know where you are.
I'm so delighted that you brought that up, because that's one of the things that I really try to stress with my students, is that when you, I think it's very important if you study any foreign language that you have an absolute sense of awe and reverence for the people that that are translators, because it is such a skill and an art and a gift. And as you said, there are translations where they try to be extremely literal, and then there are translations that are wildly different from what the actual Latin or the actual Greek will say, but yet it sounds so, it perfectly captures the sense of it, the style of it, the essence of what the Latin or Greek author was trying to say. It perfectly captures it in English, even though it might be wildly different from what the literal translation is. And one of the things that I always do with all of my students is make sure that we look at various translations. And I tell them, if you're in a used bookstore, and for instance, students that might be reading Ovid's Metamorphoses with me, if you're in a bookstore, pick up a couple of translations of Ovid and turn to the stories that we've read together and read them and compare them. It's fascinating. And once you have that insider's knowledge of knowing exactly how the Latin, how Ovid himself laid out the story, it's really fascinating to see how wildly different, what wildly different directions the translators go. I find that fascinating.
You know, I was dumb lucky, though, when we did our first Greek play in 57. I just happened across, I decided to do a Greek play, never having read one. And so I went to a bookstore and I found the Oedipus plays by Fitz and Fitzgerald. And I thought, what a stroke of luck. Mm-hmm. We did Antigone. And I will never, ever forget numberless of the world's wonders, but none more wonderful than man. Mm-hmm. Storm Gracie, you know, I thought, this is beautiful. Just gorgeous. I wonder if it's accurate. And how do you, someone once said, world is full of wonders, but wonderful is a very weak translation of the original Greek. Mm-hmm. And it's, what he's saying is, it's, mankind is terrible in a sense of the godlike terror that you, and so on and on. I thought, boy, we're just scratching the surface looking at what this is about. And I realized then how inadequate we are to realizing the great strength and beauty of the original.
And I have to say another thing, too, related to this, because it's such an interesting topic of reading works in translation and knowing a little bit about the original language and what the connection is between those two. There's always a point with my upper-level students at which we are into a text and we're reading something, and my class will come to the conclusion, and they're usually tiny classes, like a Homer class of where they were reading Homer's Odyssey, and there are six students in the room, advanced students that I've had for four or five semesters. And they'll get to a point where they'll say to me, I know exactly what this says in the Greek, and I have no idea how to render it into the English. And that's when I truly know that they've arrived, because they can see it and they can understand it and they can feel it in the Greek, but there may not even be a way to sufficiently convey it fully in the English, but it makes perfect sense in Greek. And I'm fascinated by that. I think that's the moment when you truly know that you've arrived inside of any foreign language kind of study, is when you're, when you can think and feel and hear it in the original language in a way that is stronger and more powerful and more clear than trying to figure out how to convert it to your native language.
How I envy you being able to do that. I've looked at those Greek plays. We've done all of Sophocles, all of Aeschylus, more than half of Euripides, all of Aristophanes except Lysistrata. Can't do that in public. I think, boy, you really don't know, as long as you've been working with these plays, you really don't know what you're dealing with. It's an approximation. And it bothers me that I'm not really able to get into it as I could if I spoke the original language, if I understood it. But I think if I did, I would be even further confused.
Well, I have to say something, Don, that I haven't told you, and that is that I grew up here in Davenport, and my whole childhood, my mother would take us to see your plays.
Oh.
And I think probably my first exposure to Greek tragedy was seeing them in the park. Your productions. And my recollection is that, you know, even looking back on what I remember of those experiences, and they were continuous. It was every summer we went and looked forward to what you had produced. And my recollection is that you did a pretty fine job.
Well, it was always, and I was keenly aware, it was always an approximation. For example, just as a publicity stunt, I decided we would use masks. It took us a couple of seasons to work out a mask that would work. And then once we got that, then we developed a style, a ritual style. And I thought, I have no idea how this relates to the original, or even if it does. And I've often thought of writing down what we have done and call it a barbarian looks at Greek tragedy. But you're always aware that what you're doing is an approximation. At least it seems so to me.
Well, I think that's wonderful that you have an appreciation for the fact that you're not reading them in the original. And I think oftentimes modern readers read things that are translated from other languages and they don't have any sense. They don't have any awareness in the back of their mind that this is a translation of the original. And I think that realization alone makes you a much more insightful reader and a much more careful reader. And I think that's a good lesson for everyone, that if you're reading a translation of something in French or something in German, it is exactly that. It is a translation. And you will get an entirely different feel and flavor and nuances that blossom if you're reading it in the original tongue.
In Agamemnon, Cassandra lets out this cry with, so I recall something like oi, 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 or something like, and you wonder, I wonder what that was. I wonder how that sounded. I have no idea. And so we just, whatever the actress can come up with, I have no idea how that sounded.
Well, it's interesting because teachers of the classical languages have to do a little bit of, I mean, there's plenty of guesswork involved in teaching ancient languages and ancient literature and archaeology and art and culture. I mean, we're hundreds of years removed from these civilizations. And so,
Try thousands of years.
Thousands of years, exactly. So when you are thinking about pronunciation, for instance, pronunciation of ancient Greek, now, there are certain philologists who have dedicated their lives to studying what ancient Greek might have sounded like to a 5th century Athenian citizen. And there isn't complete agreement among philological scholars about what that might have sounded like. You know, Greek is a heavily accented language, but they believe that those accent marks are actually pitch marks, like you were talking about with hearing a pitched language. And so there are always an interesting band of people who have kind of dedicated themselves to wanting to hear it as it originally sounded. Yeah. I'm exactly the opposite. I feel that you gain reading fluency and that it's a gift to the extant literature that survived. and we can't know quite what it sounded like. But I'm always fascinated to hear scholars and people who've studied the language far longer than I have attempt to give their rendition of what they feel the Greek, you know, reading Homer would have sounded like.
I remember the Oxbridge people decided it was Cicero instead of Cicero, and I thought, I don't care, I'm going to use Cicero.
Well, that's absolutely true, because in classical Latin, a C could not make an S sound. It only made a hard. Yes, exactly. It only made a, yeah, and that means chickpea, by the way. It means garbanzo bean. I always tell my students that, and they're very amused.
But I read not long ago that Cicero was constantly scolding people who wrote in Latin because he felt that they did not do a proper job. And even in the middle of Latin, if when it was spoken, well, actually Greek was spoken probably at least as frequently, if not more so than Latin. But that he was scolding people for improper use, I think, boy, he should be around today.
Well, he was an absolute master of eloquence and style in his time, and still to this day. I mean, I think if anything is taught on oratory and diction and speech writing and so on, you always have to start with Cicero. I mean, he's just a master of prose composition in general, and he's extremely difficult to read in Latin because he's known for what's called a periodic style, where he embeds subordinate clauses within subordinate clauses within subordinate clauses. And when I took Latin at Carleton, I took it intensively. So I had it 5 days a week, and I did a year's worth of Latin in one semester. And the second semester, I was thrown into a Cicero class, and I was given the Pro Archia to read, one of his legal treatises. And I remember doing my homework. I still have a tiny little text that I used. It was not much larger than a deck of cards, beautiful little Cicero edition, hardback, but just tiny. It could have fit in my back pocket. And I remember writing in the margins that there was a sentence that I was trying to puzzle through that was 105 words long. And there are no words in Latin for A. There are no definite or indefinite articles. So all of the words were substantial words. And I was trying to piece through this sentence that was 105 words long. And our modern ear wouldn't accept a sentence that's 105 words long. We would turn off. We would stare into the middle distance. We would lose our focus. And for him to have crafted orations that were composed of sentences that are over 100 words long is really mind-blowing and gives you a really profound appreciation for the style in which he wrote.
You know, I've mentioned before in this program that I was in the seminary for a couple of years. That's when I took Latin most intensively, to no avail. And then at the time, I was informed that when I got out of St. Ambrose, I was going to be sent to Rome. And one of my classmates was sent to Rome. And after the first year, he came back and told me what a terrifying thing it was, because all the classes were taught in Latin. And he took a class in Hebrew, taught in Latin by a Spaniard.
Oh,
and he said, I did not understand a word he said. Nothing. And he puzzled through and somehow blundered into a translation on his final exam. It was a 3-hour long. My seven listeners have heard this. At my age, I repeat all my stories again and again. But he struggled just to get the first word. If I could just get the first word. And the first word was rorate. And he thought, this is the antiphon we sing every night. So he just wrote it out at the last minute, got an A, went on vacation. He came back and he said, I could understand everything he said. He says, I don't know what happened. But that first semester was just agony. And the second semester, I understood him. You wonder how that happens.
Well, I think when you study the ancient languages, you aren't honing your listening and your speaking skills. I mean, it's entirely about reading fluency. I mean, yeah. The way that ancient languages are taught, and there's a movement to teach them like modern languages, but they aren't modern languages. And so you're working toward reading fluency, and so you really don't develop a sharp ear or a sharp tongue in terms of hearing it. So it makes perfect sense to me that your friend would go, and his Latin might have been perfectly adequate, but he hadn't developed that ear for hearing it spoken. And once he had a semester of kind of getting that into his system, then he was able to recognize it and sort of free up his mind. But it makes sense to me that he would struggle.
You know, I ran across a little book when it was first hinted that that might happen to me. I picked up a little book of conversational Latin. And the only one I remember is perhaps the most useless one I can think of. Iacta in altera puer. Set them up in the other alley, boy, because there are no pin boys anymore. I'm talking to Liz Mercier about Latin, and if that doesn't grab your attention, what's wrong? We'll be back in a little bit, but we have to divert now for the composer's datebook.